lecture proving the existence of God, and I had some prefatory remarks that I wanted to make before we got into the proof itself. I have a couple more of those remarks, and then we'll get on with how we can show objectively the truth of God's existence. To understand what I'm doing when I prove God's existence, however, and this ties in with something that came up in earlier questions today when Marty was lecturing, you need to understand that an argument need not be accepted by everyone for it to be conclusive. An argument need not be accepted by everyone to be conclusive. What I'm getting at here, to put it another way, is there's a difference between proof and persuasion. You can prove something even though you've not persuaded your opponent. And I know many well-meaning Christians engaged in apologetics, and especially those who want to do it in a presuppositional way, can get misled because when they talk to people and they give what seems to be a really good argument or a refutation, when the person you're talking to doesn't cry uncle, you say, oh, I must have done something wrong. Well, that's not necessarily true. You may have done everything right, but your opponent does not want to give in. Believe it or not, people are not completely rational. There are other things that affect the behavior and the attitudes and the verbal responses of people besides whether they see the truth or not, or whether they want to see the truth or not. The Bible tells us that people are spiritually blind and they have hard hearts. And so you could hold up the truth in front of somebody who is spiritually blind, and you might, and none of us ever do a perfect job, but hypothetically, you could do it perfectly. Absolute fidelity to the Word of God. And if the person remains blind, they're not going to say, oh, you're right, I guess. God must change the hearts of people. And as you were already instructed, it's not our job to convert people. The Holy Spirit does conversion. Our job, the way I like to put it is, it's our job to close their mouths. And it's the Holy Spirit's job to open their hearts. If you can show that they have nothing to say against the faith or that what they're offering can be reduced to absurdity, you've done your job. You have defended the faith. You've been loyal to your Lord, faithful to His Word. You close the mouth of the opponent. But whether the Holy Spirit opens the heart so that the light might get in and bring a new life to them or not is really in God's sovereign disposition. And so you must not judge your apologetical efforts on the basis of how many notches you have on your belt. Oh, another conversion this afternoon. I'm doing pretty well. Sadly, I mean, I'm overplaying that. I trust no Christian really goes home with this, hey, I've got another notch on the belt attitude. I mean, explicitly. But subtly, that comes out when we think, you know, if I could just do a really good job, then another person would come to the Lord and listen. I hope that God has blessed my ministry in apologetics. When I see people like Marty lecturing, I believe that I'm doing something right. I'm proud of him and others like him. But the fact of the matter is, none of that's me. You know, I'm not smarter than other people or more spiritual than other people. It's not anything that's in me. It's God's grace that changes any of us. And that's why presuppositionalists of all people ought to be the most humble when they defend the faith. Because when I reduce my opponent to absurdity, if this grant that I can do that or I have done that occasionally, when I've reduced him to absurdity, I don't stand over him, you know, like some kind of warrior and say, macho Dr. Bonson. I have to tell him while he's laying on the ground bleeding, I've been there too. And the only thing that, you know, raises you up on your feet, or to use the biblical figure of speech, the only thing that gives you new life is the love and grace of God. And the only reason I hurt you is because I want you to know how good God is. All of us are fools until Jesus changes us. And then the world thinks we've really become fools by following Jesus. But in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, Paul tells us that what the world calls foolishness is the wisdom and the power of God. And you know what God does with this foolishness of the world? He destroys the wisdom of the world. And so in apologetics, by God's grace, If you are faithful to the Lord, you can reduce your opponent to foolishness, to absurdity. But when you do it for the sake of his coming to a new life. Yet the giving of that life is not your work. God does that just like he attends your argument with success. And so all the praise and the glory goes to him. I'm going to prove God's existence to you. I mean that in no arrogant way. I mean that as a philosopher. I'm going to give you what I think is a proof that God exists. And it's an objective proof. It has nothing to do with what people like or dislike, what their desires are, their subjective background, anything like that. I'm talking about proof theory now. And I'm going to show that in order to prove anything, you would have to first believe in God. Let me expand on that prefatory remark just a little bit by giving real quick background on proof theory. If I were writing an article or a book, I probably wouldn't reduce it to just four, but I think I can help you. There are essentially four ways to approach proving things. Okay? Four ways. We have different schools of thought associated with those four ways of proving things, too. And so you might think of them as the rationalist approach, the empiricist approach, I'm going to come back to this, the pragmatist approach, and then the fourth one I'll talk about when we get to it, which is what I'm going to be doing now. First of all, the rationalist approach. The word rationalism in English is very ambiguous or equivocal. It is used in, I'd say a dozen, but even that is not correct. A couple dozen, three dozen different ways in the history of philosophy you can find rationalism, rationalist use. But when we speak of the rationalist approach to proof, what we mean is something is proven when it uses clear and distinct ideas in a logical fashion. If you can come up with a logical presentation of what are considered self-evident or clear, distinct concepts, then you have proven it. And in the history of philosophy, you have a school of thought known as continental rationalism, represented by men like Descartes and Spinoza and Leibniz. And all three of these men, interestingly, thought that they were using logically sound and conceptually clear ideas that were self-evident, so that whatever conclusions they came to based on those self-evident and logical processes of reasoning, anybody who is rational would have to accept. Now, I can't do the whole history of philosophy with you, but the really ironic thing, sadly, is that for all of the clearness and distinctness of their ideas and for all of their logical soundness, Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz came up with radically different philosophies. That kind of tips you off that maybe it's not so self-evident after all. Descartes was a dualist. He thought all of reality is divided into two kinds of things, mind or matter, essentially. Spinoza was a pantheist. He thought mind and matter were just two different ways of looking at the very same thing. Leibniz was what we call an atomist. In fact, he was a spiritual atomist. I don't know of any other one in the history of philosophy anywhere. He believed all reality is made up of an infinite number of bits of something. But they are not bits of matter. They are bits of energy or mind, which he called monads. Okay, you may want to know more about that. You can get my history of philosophy series and so forth. But here's the interesting thing. Rationalist says, okay, we're going to start with self-evident ideas and use logic, and we're going to come to conclusions. And they come to radically different conclusions. So you have, obviously, an unreliable approach here because of the disagreement and the ultimate subjectivism of what's considered self-evident. The second approach to proof theory, in terms of our simplistic analysis, is called empiricism. E-M-P-I-R-I-C-I-S-I-S-M. Empiricism. E-M-P. I-R-I-C-I-S-M. Did I put too many syllables in there? Hey, I didn't say I could spell. Okay. E-M-P-I-R-I-C-I-S-M. Sorry about that. Empiricism, or the empiricist, says, well, let me put it this way. a rationalist says, if you want to know if something's true, stop and think about it. Stop and reflect on it. I'm trying to be real simple. That is, it's not so much going out and researching something. Stop and think about it. Are your concepts clear, self-evident, and logical? The empiricist says, go look and see. The empiricist says, we know things through our senses, or if you will, by observation. Most people who have not gone to college or have studied philosophy, at least in our culture, I have to be careful, most people in American culture would think that they are probably empiricists. Seeing is believing. So if you're going to prove something to me, you're going to have to put it in so I can see it, taste it, touch it, smell it, hear it, whatever. The problem with empiricism are basically problems in what we call cognitive psychology. Problems in cognitive psychology. John Locke was an empiricist, the father of what's known as British empiricism. And John Locke struggled with the psychology of knowing things, or learning, the psychology of learning, if everything is based upon some kind of sensation or observation. And Locke finally came to the conclusion that he couldn't really know things in the world or know that the world outside of himself was real. He also thought, well, everybody's going to give me a break on this and, you know, I can slide by on it. But Locke essentially locked us all up into our own sensations. If all I know are my sensations, then how can I be sure that there's an external world that corresponds to my sensations? Because remember, I never know the external world. I only know my sensations of the external world. And so George Berkeley worked on that and came up with an interesting solution that you don't want to know about, but it was called subjective idealism. Berkeley said something exists if it's perceived. To which people said, well, that's kind of silly. Then, therefore, the socks in my drawer right now at home don't exist because no one's perceiving them. Berkeley, being a devout Christian, by the way, had an answer to that. I don't consider this really all that noble, but his answer was, well, God's looking at everything all the time, so the socks still do exist. But as a human view of psychology, or the psychology of knowing, that's not very adequate. Then David Hume got hold of this, and he totally destroyed it, because he said, if all we know are the things we observe, then we don't know that there's a world of causation out there, because no one ever sees causation. I realize you're sitting there saying, women, I see it all the time. Haven't you watched a game of billiards or pool? We see the cue ball goes across the table, hits another ball, causes it to move. And that's what my lecture is going to be on, so I'll come back to it. But trust me, you don't see causation. You see succession. You see one event and another event, and you draw the connection mentally. You do not see causation. Moreover, you don't see your own personal identity. Are you the same person who was born or birthed by your mother? Everyone chuckles because you say, oh, hey, come on, Dr. Bonson, common sense. There are things you can take for granted. Well, you know what? And that's one thing I like about philosophy. It's a vicious department. And so, though we might all want to get along and say, yeah, we all know that we were birthed by our mothers, the philosopher is going to say, yeah, but your theory of knowledge, if that's true, then that should be an excellent specimen of how your theory of knowledge works. Because we all know that one's true, so test your theory by that. Try testing your theory of personal identity back to this baby that your mother gave birth to. Has anyone ever seen the continuity of personal identity through time? Forget somebody else. I mean, that's problematic enough. How about yourself? You look at that little picture of you when you were so adorable, and you say, that's the same person. It's the same person? Did you see continuity through time? Did you observe continuity? Did you feel continuity through time? The answer is no, you didn't. And so Hume said, we don't know causation. We don't know personal identity. And he went on to give a number of other things, and I am not kidding you. Every graduate, well, some undergraduate students in good departments, every graduate student that has to read Hume will verify for you. He says right in his writings, he gets to the place where he's so frustrated where he says, well, then we can't know anything. And at that point he says, I want to go play backgammon with my friends. That's the best the unbelieving world could do in empiricism. Empiricism, which starts out seeming so reasonable, seeing is believing, ends up telling us we can't know anything at all. So empiricism leads to problems in cognitive psychology and proves to be self-defeating and leads to skepticism and David Hume playing backgammon rather than writing another book. So the rationalist approach is unreliable. The empiricist approach reduces to skepticism, and this led after a while in the history of epistemology to what's known as pragmatism. The pragmatist says, I'm not going to answer the problems that the rationalist was trying to answer, and I'm not going to answer the problems of empiricism. I'm going to ignore them as utterly irrelevant. And I can give you, I think you probably have, but I can give you some sympathy for the pragmatist, because essentially the pragmatist says, while you philosophers, you know, are diddling away trying to answer all these intellectual questions, we're still living our lives. This hasn't kept anybody from knowing, step out of the way of the train, you know, plant in the spring, harvest in the fall, sort of thing. We live our lives anyway. So the pragmatist says, forget those traditional problems of philosophy. The only thing that matters is adjusting to your environment and being successful at life. Pragmatist says, truth has nothing to do with being rational or having evidence. Truth is simply a matter of what works. And again, I'm bringing this down to a real elementary level. I'm being oversimple, but it'll put you on the right track. The pragmatist says, truth isn't a matter of evidence, and it isn't a matter of logic. It's a matter of what gets you by. Truth is what works. And so, if you seek the proper end, and you're successful in reaching it, then you've got the truth. If the hypothesis that you're following doesn't get you to that end, if you haven't solved your problems, if you haven't been successful, then it isn't true. And I hope that some of you are budding philosophers and you don't have to be spoon-fed this. You're sitting there saying, well, that all assumes you know what the proper end is. Successful at what? What are we supposed to do? And in an article that we don't have available, you can't read today, but if you want to pursue this, I go through, in terms of modern publications and academic theories, different versions of what the pragmatist's goal is supposed to be. Is it the preservation of the race? Is it the individual's adjustment to his environment? You have to know what you're supposed to be here for. And by the way, I would say this as a Christian to the pragmatist. Well, whatever you do, you want to make sure that you live your life in such a way that on the day of final judgment, God finds you acceptable. Because, you see, if you live 40, 50, 60 years, and you seem to have done real well in your biological or economic or social environment, but then you go to hell forever, I'd say that's pretty counter-utilitarian. That is, it wasn't very useful, was it? So the pragmatist needs to not only know what the proper end in life is, the pragmatist must also know whether there's a heaven or hell, God, and so forth. But that puts him right back into the traditional problems of philosophy. You can't decide whether you're being successful if you're going to be short-sighted and just say success is just in the short run. Let me get through this life. Or maybe what? A year, or a month, or a day, or a minute. Who knows? What are we supposed to be living for? You can't make pragmatic judgments. You can make arbitrary pragmatic judgments, but you know that's got to be tossed out. You can't make pragmatic judgments without the traditional questions being answered, it turns out. And so pragmatism, when all is said and done, is really a refusal to look at the tough questions. Pragmatism is intellectual adolescence. And I realize a lot of pragmatists out there, you know, would be insulted by that kind of language. But what I mean is this. The pragmatist is like, don't take this wrong, it's like elementary students such as yourself listening to a week or two of these lectures on all these tough questions and then saying, oh, forget it. The only thing that matters is whether I get through. If I'm living my life and I'm happy and so forth, then that's truth. Truth is what works. And that's really an avoiding of the tough questions rather than an answering of the tough questions. Okay, so I'm not going to try to prove that God exists rationally. That is, in terms of clear and distinct ideas, logically, you know, carried out. I'm not going to try to prove that God exists empirically. It's like we can go to the pantry and open up and see if there's a box of crackers there and say, oh, lo and behold, God exists. Y'all remember the Russian cosmonaut who went up in space a number of years ago and came back and he said he knew there was no God because he went out in space and didn't see him? That really happened. Am I telling the truth, Gary? That really happened. I know that just sounds so stupid, but empiricists will expect you, if you're going to prove anything, you're going to have to give some observational evidence of it. And say, God's not the sort of thing you can prove observationally. Well, then he doesn't exist. I'm not going to try to satisfy the empiricist, and I'm not going to try to prove that God exists pragmatically by saying, hey, your life will go better. You know, it's kind of like things go better with Coke, right? Well, but if you have God, things go even better than with Coke. No, I'm not going to be a pragmatist in my approach. Okay, so how am I going to prove God's existence? You may think, Gary may be worrying I'm using up all my time, you may think all this is just prefatory. If you see what I'm getting at, I've really almost got to the place where the proof can be over. I'll take a few minutes to do it. The only way you can prove something ultimate, like the existence of God transcendentally, it's not a word we've been using, but now we're going to use it for the sake of shorthand. I could define transcendental proof over and over and over again every time I want to use it, but then I'd really run out of time in my lectures. So I'm going to define the word, explain the concept, and then use it. A transcendental proof asks, what are the preconditions of intelligibility? That is, what are the transcendentals? That's a archaic philosophical word, I realize. When we say, what are the transcendentals, we're saying, what must be true for something to make sense? What are the preconditions of intelligibility? The preconditions. What sorts of things would we have to think are true in order for something to make sense, to be intelligible? Remember our checklist I went over? Said, are these considerations arbitrary? Are they inconsistent? What are the consequences? And then finally, and this is where apologetics gets, you know, in high gear, what are the preconditions of intelligibility, right? What are the transcendentals? A transcendental proof argues from the impossibility of the contrary, saying you have an ultimate presupposition, I have an ultimate presupposition, and the problem with yours is, or the contrary of mine, is that if what you say is true, we couldn't prove anything. Nothing would be intelligible. Nothing would make sense on your presupposition. And so you prove your presupposition by the impossibility of the contrary. You say, my presupposition provides the transcendentals, the preconditions of intelligibility. In the debate that I'm hoping that you all now will order, and you've heard me summarize already, the particular form of transcendental argument that I used with Dr. Stein was the transcendentals of logic. There are other kinds, and that's what I'm going to give you here in just a moment. Basically, I said, Dr. Stein, doing a debate presupposes the laws of logic. You have to have something by which you evaluate arguments or lines of reasoning. But now, what would have to be true for there to be laws of logic? To answer that, you have to say, well, what are laws of logic? Are laws of logic like marbles? You know, can you trip on them on the ground? Could you accidentally swallow a law of logic? No, it's not a material thing at all. A law of logic is abstract. It's immaterial. Not only is it abstract, it's universally applicable, and it's absolute. It admits of no exceptions. And so what I want to know, Dr. Stein, is given your worldview, could there be anything that is abstract, universal, and absolute? And, of course, being an atheist, there can't. He's a materialist. That is, to put it simply, for him, only marbles exist, and things like marbles, things you can touch that are hard. Or they don't have to necessarily be hard, but they're perceivable through the senses. The smell of a rose exists, but that's because there's something that's not so much hard that nevertheless you can have a sense experience of. But the laws of logic, you can't smell the laws of logic. Some people think they're smelly, but you can't smell the laws of logic. You can't take the laws of logic. You can't trip over them. Couldn't buy them in the store if you wanted to. You can buy books on logic, but books on logic are not the laws of logic, just like books on mathematics are not numbers. I know, every year I have to do this with these people. Can you see a number? The intelligent people are saying no, and the people who know they don't know the answer are sitting there in cold fear. Don't call on me. Class, is that the number three?
No.
Well, then it must be another number. It must be the number four, the number five, right? No, the trick in that question, it's the alumni of LPC that got it right. You cheated. Okay. The trick here is that I ask you, is that the number? That is the numeral three. That is a transcription of a number. But you can't see the number three. If that were the number three, guess what? There ain't no more threeness. I just destroyed threeness. Oh, no! Go to the store and something costs $1.30. You say, I'm sorry, there aren't any more threes. Okay, books on math are not books that show you math. They're transcriptions and discussions of, but you can't see numbers and you can't see the laws of logic and so forth. So let's get back to Dr. Stein. Again, you understand I'm saying, what are the preconditions of intelligibility? Debate presupposes laws of logic. Laws of logic presuppose that there are abstract, universal, and abstract entities. I said abstract, absolute entities. You don't believe there are such things because you're a materialist. Therefore, your worldview destroys the possibility of logic, in which case your worldview destroys the possibility of debate. Since you came to the debate, therefore, you must have been assuming a Christian worldview when you came. And so, as you know, I argued that your coming to the debate means that I win. The very effort to argue already assumes what I'm trying to prove. That's what's known as an argument from the impossibility of the contrary, or an argument that is transcendental. So now my summary is proof theory, elementary, simplistic summary. Prove things rationally, empirically, pragmatically, or transcendentally. I would call that presuppositional proof, but there's literature out there where other people use the word presupposition and don't mean it in this way. And that's very sad. That's another lecture. So I'm going to call it transcendental proof, proving from the impossibility of the contrary. And now I'm going to prove God's existence. It won't take too long. Really, getting set up for this is the most important part. It turns out that none of us can know anything from our experience unless we assume the uniformity of nature. That's the pedestrian way of putting it. If I were in a philosophy hall, I probably would not say that because that's kind of ambiguous and so forth. But you know what I'm talking about. I'm saying the world that we experience demonstrates continuity or uniformity. You can pretty much expect that the experiences you've... In fact, you can so much expect that the experiences you have will be repeated in the future, that if you have what appears to be a similar experience and you don't have the same effect or consequence, you will automatically think there's been a change somehow. Okay? So, stubbing the toe. Use that example. Most of you will try to avoid stubbing your toe at night if you're walking around in a dark house or college room or something like that. Why is that? Well, because you've had experiences, if you're smart, one experience in the past. For those who are a bit slow, two or three. For the really dumb, 10, 11, 12. But you've had experiences in the past of stubbing your toe, and you didn't like that. That hurt. But notice, you automatically, without getting a PhD in philosophy, you will now assume that if I stub my toe in the future, it hurts. And so you try to avoid that. Uniformity of nature. Now, it wouldn't have to be that way. Stop and think about it. Maybe the second time you stub your toe, or maybe the universe is organized in such a way that every third time that you stub your toe, it's the thrill of a lifetime. Whoa! I need some more of that. But we don't think that way, do we? Stubbing your toe wouldn't have to be painful. It wouldn't have to be. But it so happens that you've learned that it is, and you assume what? That since it was in the past, it will be in the future. Now, that little simple illustration, because we had some humor built into it, may mislead you into thinking that I'm just diddling here. Everything you know assumes the uniformity of nature. Everything you know. Your name. If I were to call you by name and say, that who you are? Hey, Bill, that you? You'd say yes. What did you assume? You assumed that this name that picked you out or indexed you, as we say, in the past, still indexes you or names you today. In fact, when you use language, you assume the uniformity of nature, don't you? You've learned what zucchini means in the past, right? Living doorstop. No. You've learned what zucchini means, and so when you use zucchini in a sentence, the word zucchini, you're assuming it's going to have the same kind of effect or consequences, communicate the same meaning as it did previously. The laws of mathematics assume the uniformity of nature, too. I know that sounds strange because math is supposed to be something that doesn't touch the physical world so much. But think about it. Last week, you girls, when you baked the cake, I take that back. What a sexist remark. You boys or girls who bake the cake, sexist or not, I only want the girls who bake the cake. You guys can keep your cakes. When you baked the cake, you had a certain recipe you followed, okay? And you assumed that since that recipe baked the cake previously, when I put these things together, it's going to make a cake again. Wouldn't you be shocked if it turned into an alligator? Well, you know, the world's not that way. Everything we know assumes the uniformity of nature. And so let our worldviews, in order to show that God, the Christian God, is the starting point for all reasoning and all argumentation. Since everybody who reasons with you will assume the uniformity of nature is also called the causal principle or the inductive principle. So if I fall back into that, you know what I'm getting at. Inductive means you can induce from particular experiences a generalization about the future. The inductive principle, or the causal principle, the uniformity of nature, is assumed in all reasoning and argumentation. And so I want to set atheism and Christian theism as worldviews side by side and ask now, which of these worldviews provides the preconditions for rationality? The preconditions for intelligible experience. The preconditions for science. You know, Marty made a really good point earlier when he said, people may say that they don't expect uniformity, but they put millions of dollars into a space program, and they build these rockets, and they get ready on the countdown. You don't see them sitting there thinking, boy, what a crapshoot this universe is. I wonder if it's going to go up. People don't do that. The intelligibility of the scientific endeavor just assumes this world is uniform. And so, let's go back and ask and reconsider an argument with respect now to causality. Is there causation in this world? Is there causation? You know, when you talk to the unbeliever, I guarantee you're going to have to educate him because he's going to say everybody knows there's causation. That's not unique to you Christians. Remember what Van Til said. Everybody counts, not everybody can account for counting. So you want to say, oh, we know that everybody uses the causal principle. In fact, we encourage you to use it. That's the only way to get by in this world. We want you to account for the causal principle. Why do you assume the future will be like the past? The causal principle is one of those general principles by which inferences are drawn and the particular data of sensation can be organized into law-like expectations so that we might now live successfully in the world. Causation is not mere succession of events. If causation were mere succession, then I could tell you why eggs fry when you put them on the griddle, at the griddle pond. It's because the alarm clock went off that morning. Isn't that what you were going to say? The alarm went off, 6 o'clock. I got up, took my shower, went to the kitchen, cracked the eggs on the hot griddle. They fried. It must be the alarm clock that caused the eggs to fry. And somebody says, no. Dr. Bonson, the fact that it preceded doesn't mean that it caused it. That's just succession of events. Mere succession, event A, alarm clock ringing, event B, eggs frying. Those two things are not necessarily connected. This is what David Hume said. He said causation is not just succession of events, it's necessary succession of events. Now, can we see succession of events? I'm not going to get real advanced on, because I could argue you don't even see succession, because succession assumes temporal understanding, and no one sees temporality, but that's way too advanced. Let's just say we do see succession. I see this, cracking of the eggs, hot griddle, I see it frying. I see succession of events. But do I see any necessary connection between the two? I'm granting we see a temporal succession. I mean temporarily, I'm granting. We do see a temporal succession. We don't see a necessary connection. David Hume granted that. Now, let me go one better here. Time's running out. I'm almost done anyway. I wanted to go through an article by Bertrand Russell. Now, you're going to be reading something by Bertrand Russell entitled Why I'm Not a Christian. So no one can suspect me here of sneaking in somebody that's really sympathetic to religion or to Christianity, and so that's why he's saying these things. Bertrand Russell hated Christianity. I'm passing out one article. There's a whole book of articles by Russell entitled, taking the title from that, Why I'm Not a Christian. He has Whether Religion Has Made Positive Contributions to Civilization, and on and on and on. He hated religion, and he hated Christianity in particular. And so, in his Problems of Philosophy, published in 1967, Russell has a chapter entitled On Induction. Now, you all know what induction is. It's this principle that our experience in the past is a reliable guide to how things will happen in the future. And in the article, he goes through various ways you could rationally, or not in terms of the school of rationalism, but how you could intellectually justify the principle of induction. And I just want you to hear his conclusion. He says the inductive principle is incapable of being proved by an appeal to experience. Somebody says, oh, I know why the sun will rise tomorrow. I know why the eggs will fry. I know why. And he'll say, why? Well, because I've experienced it. And Russell will think, you cannot prove the inductive principle by appealing to experience. Experience, I'm now reading again, experience might conceivably confirm the inductive principle as regards the cases that have been already examined. Okay, all those past experiences might be confirmed by experience. But as regards unexamined cases, future cases, or it doesn't even have to be future, if eggs fry on a hot griddle in America, do they do that in China too? You say, well, we assume that they do. He says, yeah, but you haven't examined those cases. But as regards unexamined cases, it is the inductive principle alone that can justify any inference from what has been examined to what has not been examined. It's a crucial sentence. And it's also what puts the noose right around his unbelieving neck. Because he says, if you appeal to experience to prove eggs fry in China or eggs will fry next Tuesday, he says, you're assuming the inductive principle. And so experience does not justify the inductive principle. It's the inductive principle that allows you to use experience and draw conclusions about unexamined cases. All arguments which on the basis of experience argue as to the future or the unexperienced parts of the past or present assume the inductive principle. Hence, we can never use experience to prove the inductive principle without begging the question. Uh-oh. Bertrand Russell, expert in 20th century logic, says if we use the inductive principle, we're begging the question, which is the logical fallacy. Thus, we must either accept the inductive principle on the ground of its intrinsic evidence or forego all justification of our expectations about the future. He says there's two options. Of course, being an unbeliever, he's excluding the third option, which is we know that nature is uniform because God, the personal God, who created the heavens and the earth and sovereignly controls everything that happens right down to the hairs of our head, that God makes the future like the past and amenable to our knowledge so that we can get to know it, subdue it to his glory. But Russell says, no, it's either the intrinsic evidence for it or there is no justification whatsoever. Well, if there's no justification, that is to say, believing in the inductive principle is irrational or arbitrary. Remember that? Here's a man talking about the most basic principle of science. And he says, we're going to be rational. Here's a man who hates the living and true God, is going to give you all kinds of arguments against this. And he says, but when all is said and done, that principle that is the foundation for all of our reasoning is arbitrary. He begins with an irrational starting point, and from that point on says, I'm going to strictly be rational. He says, or we have to accept it on its intrinsic evidence. By the way, this is cute, especially for somebody who was as technically proficient as Bertrand Russell was in philosophy. Intrinsic evidence is just a real slimy, euphemistic way of saying what is accepted on its own evidence, self-evidently. It's intrinsic evidence. And so he says, the general principles of science, such as the belief in the reign of law and the belief that every event must have a cause, are as completely dependent upon the inductive principle as are the beliefs of daily life. All such general principles are believed because mankind has found innumerable instances of their truth and no instances of their falsehood. But this affords no evidence for their truth in the future unless the inductive principle is assumed. So what we have here is the unbeliever himself giving us all the evidence we need that only the Christian worldview provides the preconditions of intelligibility for science, for reasoning, for language. It is the most reasonable thing in the world to believe in God. It is entirely unreasonable not to believe in God. Is that? Because God's existence is the precondition for all reasoning. I'm going to read that again. In fact, I wouldn't mind using my last 3 minutes just to read it over and over again. I want this to sink in. Now, I set all of this up by talking to you about proof theory, about how subjective considerations are irrelevant, and on and on and on. I am simply talking about objective matters pertaining to intelligibility or reason. And how I prove God's existence now is by showing that it's entirely unreasonable not to believe in God, which is to say it's entirely reasonable to believe in God, because God's existence is the precondition for all reasoning. Anytime the unbeliever wants to reason with you, he's lost. Later in the week you may ask me about this. Okay, what about people who finally get the point? No laws of logic on the non-Christian worldview. No inductive principle on the non-Christian worldview. No moral absolutes on the non-Christian worldview. No dignity for man on the non-Christian worldview. No freedom of the mind on the non-Christian worldview. All of which are assumed in the reasoning or arguing or debating process. And so the unbeliever says, well then, fine. I won't believe in God, and so I just won't reason or debate with you. Well, if you want to know the apologetical answer, it is, okay, fine. Well, then you concede that we're right and you're wrong. Because, you see, the fact that you won't cry uncle doesn't mean that I don't have you in a hammerlock. Remember what I said? Proof and persuasion are two different things. And your job is not to make him cry uncle. It'd be wonderful if he did, but believe me, if he does, it won't be because your arguments are so sterling, it's because the Holy Spirit's so strong. You shut his mouth, the Holy Spirit, by God's grace, will open his heart. So I'm not claiming that a profession of God's existence is necessary to engage in reasoning. I'm rather claiming that the atheistic worldview cannot provide a cogent reason for what we necessarily assume in all reasoning. That is, atheism cannot make sense out of our reasoning and must be dismissed as just another version of intellectual arbitrariness. Atheists are living by habitual conditioning. They are living by, on their worldview, blind faith regarding the rationality of the universe. When I debated Dr. Stein at the University of California, at one point I said, and the audience, you know, nodded in agreement, they laughed and clapped and so forth, I said, you know, the problem with atheism is you just have to live by so much faith. And I just don't have that much faith.